got to have a plan. We must have a plan even if it is wrong. There would come scattered, polite applause. Chairs scraped as everyone turned their attention to Cassidy's table. Some veterans muttered approval at these odd sentiments, while the new guys looked around in stark confusion. After waiting for the buzz to die down, Cassidy continued, "I realize world team bowling is a relatively new concept, but gentlemen," a small chuckle here, "as our attendance figures indicate, it is a concept whose time has come." Cheers from the veterans, new guys aghast. "Now, we have made some mistakes. No one denies that." Negative mumbling. Certainly no one was going to deny that. "When our Italian all-star here, Jerry Mazzarelli, split his pants on network TV going for that spare in the sixth frame against Akron, well, gentlemen, it was a bleak moment for our fledgling organization as well as for sports in general. Certainly no one is faulting Jerry for that, but I'll tell you that all of us, players and management alike, were keeping our fingers crossed. All of us except Jerry, of course, who was doing a medium-slow crab walk with a New Brunswick double ball bag jammed in his crotch." Well, it was just old crazy Cassidy, of course, and maybe the moon was full or something. But he had eaten their bread and salt and was always walking over exhausted from his race to inquire just how was the pole vault going anyway. And to put it simply, he could get away with just about anything with them. At times he swiveled the spotlight and its harsh glare fell on those not quite so ready for wholesale craziness. It was in this way Meisner had been discovered. As a new distance man, Meisner had sat around with a dour expression through his first of Cassidy's bowling banquets, and had generally been marked off as an old maid until Cassidy suddenly presented him with some mythical honor one night. Meisner stood timidly as Cassidy handed him a Dr. Pepper can fashioned into a ridiculous trophy with a scrap of tinfoil. The new runner stared with wide eyes at the bemused, expectant faces around the room. He cleared his throat. A few veterans looked at one another. This was going to be good.
I would like to thank Mr. Cassidamius for this here award, and I'd like to say something else while I'm standing here. You know, I wasn't really nobody at all when Mr. Cassidamius found me in that little three-lane alley in Pittsburgh. Sure, I mean I was a local hotshot and all, rolling 210, 215, and just, you know, getting along. But I wasn't no serious contender is what I'm trying to tell you. Never made the cut or nothing like that. And then one day Mr. Cassidamius comes in and he watches me roll a few frames, no more than that, just a few frames. And then he comes over big as day and says, "Son," he says, "son, if you get rid of that limp wrist of yours and learn to come over the ball on your follow-through, you just might knock yourself over a few of them pins." I mark that as the turning point in my career which has led me to the point at which I am at today. He started to sit down, changed his mind, and stood back up, clearing his throat.
That, and going to the 25-pound composite ball. Thank you. They sat stunned for several seconds, finally breaking into rowdy applause that quickly became a standing ovation. Meisner looked around the room with a faint smile on his dark face, making little bows with his head. Cassidy, sitting across from him all moony-eyed, fell smack in love. 6. Bruce Denton. Quentin Cassidy would have thought it amusing had someone called him a great runner. He wasn't even the best in the neighborhood. Nor was Jerry Meisner, who could claim All-American honors at the 6-mile distance. It wasn't even close. The best runner around Kernsville was Bruce Denton, a methodical, dryly humorous doctoral candidate in botany. While both younger runners were formidable talents in collegiate circles, Denton's place in the hierarchy of distance running was lofty and secure.
The others held him in secret awe and reported his words to comrades with the solemnity of one reading from the Dead Sea Scrolls. Well, now, Denton says you should warm down like blah, blah. Such pronouncements could halt the most vociferous arguments. As an undergrad at a small school in Ohio, Denton had been a good but not spectacular performer, running the mile in 4:08. But as with many runners, he began to improve with age. He moved to Florida and took up graduate studies at Southeastern, where he began training again with a scientifically precise vengeance. On the altar of consistency, he offered up no less than 2 portions of his life per day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year. His neatly filled calendar diary told no lies, and the symbolism of the unmissed workout became ritualistic to him, taking on an importance in his life he did not like to admit, even to himself. On a rainy day in November, he was so sick with the flu that his wife, Jeannie, felt constrained to stay home from work to look after him. He threw up regularly and had diarrhea so badly his stomach muscles began cramping. Nonetheless, he arose and ran 2 eerie miles at a stumbling pace, pale and shivering the whole way. His wife was aghast. Again in the afternoon, he repeated the process, this time nearly fainting as he staggered back into the apartment. Dr. Stavius, whose claim to fame was that he had once punctured a blister on the foot of Roger Bannister, stormed into Denton's sick room and pronounced him a madman. "What crazy?" Denton asked, trying to make his parched lips form a smile. "After today, I'm 16 miles behind for the week." Over the course of several years at Southeastern, as Denton's reputation grew, a number of undergraduate runners decided they would train with him, thinking to pick up on the secret. A new man would show up the first day expecting all manner of horrific exertion and would be stunned and giddy to find he could so easily make it through one of Denton's calendar days. Showing up the second morning at 6:30, he would be of good cheer, perhaps trying to imagine how he would handle the pressure of his inevitable fame. That day would also go well enough, but he would begin to notice something peculiar. There was no let-up. The tempo was always moderate but steady. If a new guy decided to pick up the pace, that's where it stayed, whether he finished with the group or not. You showed off at your peril. On the third day, assuming the new man made it that far, his outlook would begin to darken. For one thing, he was getting very, very tired. No particular day wore him out, but the accumulation of steady mileage began to take its toll. He never quite recovered fully between workouts, and soon found himself walking around in a more or less constant state of fatigue depression, a phase Denton called breaking down. The new runner would find it more tedious than he could bear. The awful truth would begin to dawn on him. There was no secret. His days would have to be spent in exactly this manner, give or take a mile or two, for longer than he cared to think about, if he really wanted to see the olive wreath up close. It would simply be the most difficult, heart-rending process he would endure in the course of his life. At that point, most of them would drift away. They would search within themselves somewhere along a dusty 10-mile trail or during the bad part of a really gut-churning 440 on the track and find some key element missing. Sheepishly, they would begin to miss workouts, then stop showing up altogether. They would convince themselves there must be another way. There has to be. The attrition rate was nearly 100%. Only Cassidy and Meisner made it through the process and finally accepted the trial of miles. When Denton saw that they were different, he opened up to them and they discovered for the first time that the silently gliding machine at their sides all those months actually had a personality. Accustomed as they were to the flamboyance of their teammates, they were amused by Denton's penchant for understatement. Once, when he returned from the large international road race at Springbank, Canada, they gathered around his locker waiting for details. Well, they wanted to know, how did it go? "Not too badly, I guess," said Denton, dressing in his quick, methodical way. I got in a token mile in the morning and then ran a few after the race so the week's total won't suffer too much. Jogged around the Atlanta airport, too. He added the last thoughtfully, scratching his chin.
Well, goddamn, Bruce, all the Europeans are usually there. Aussies, even some Africans. Who the hell won?
Cassidy was impatient.
Oh, I won it,
Denton said breezily, apparently still thinking about the coup of getting a couple of extra miles at the airport.
Christ, you won it! Ron Hill, Dave Bedford, Frank Shorter, all those guys usually...
Yeah, Denton said, pausing in the middle of tying his shoelace, as if remembering something pleasant from his childhood. Nicest bunch of guys you'd ever want to meet. When, during his first postgraduate year, Denton came from relative obscurity to run 27:10 for 6 miles at the Drake Relays, knowledgeable distance buffs were mildly surprised that such an undistinguished performer could run an international-caliber race out of the blue. However unlikely it seemed in retrospect, at the time the phrase, flash in the pan, was bandied about. There are scoffers, it seems, in every field. Later that spring, when Denton made the U.S. Olympic team, nearly everyone professed surprise. Everyone except Dr. Stavius and a promising young miler named Quentin Cassidy, who watched the U.S. trials on television. True to form, Denton powered across the finish line in the 5,000 meters and simply jogged past the cameras over to his sweats and departed the stadium. Everyone had ignored him for so long, it seemed to Cassidy a delicious gesture. Now, 2 years after that Olympiad, though they had survived the trial of miles and knew his secret, and though they were championship collegiate runners, Cassidy and Meisner knew better than anyone that Denton played the game on an entirely different level. He was unencumbered by such things as team standings, dual meets, conference titles. As a graduate student, he ran for himself, nominally for the Southeastern University Track Club, of which he was the sole member. His fare was paid to large meets all over the country by promoters who wanted his name for their posters. During the indoor season, he would likely be found in nearly any large city in the country on a given weekend, running either a 2 mile, which he called a deuce, or a 3 mile race. He knew or had run against most of the top runners in the world. He had raced Ron Clark on the grass in Australia, winning with a big kick. He had suffered through a high-altitude 2 mile against the smiling, fierce Kip Kano, losing to a big kick. He had spent several weeks in Eugene with the Pre, listening thoughtfully to the Bowerman-Dellinger theorems, tempering his awe with miler Roscoe Devine's confession that he snuck out and ran extra workouts when the assigned ones were too easy. He had listened to Jerry Lindgren say, "bad berries" about 3,000 times during a hot 20-miler outside Spokane. He had had a long, pleasant argument with Kenny Moore as to the real value of the mileage ethic as opposed to the hard-easy theory, which ended when he told the great marathoner, "You may not believe in mileage, but you sure as hell run mileage." There was little wonder Bruce Denton had more quiet confidence than Cassidy or Meisner in the distance runner's little rigid hierarchy of black-and-white numbers, and little wonder why they held him in awe. In his apartment, there was an overburdened second bedroom that served as a guest room, study, and trophy room. In the corner was an ancient filing cabinet with locking drawers. In the bottom drawer, the only one that still locked, was a flat, oblong leather box. In that box was an Olympic gold medal. 7. Andrea.
"I'm in love with her, I tell you," Cassidy said. "You don't even know her."
"I don't care. If I knew her, it might spoil it. Did you see her little forehead, how it was all wrinkled and sweaty?
Come on.
She was concentrating on her pace, for Christ's sakes."
"Aw."
This was how it all began, back at the very start of the school year. The scrap of red yarn she carelessly tied her hair up with might have had something to do with it. Or perhaps it was the very sincere look on her face as they trundled by her on the warm-up course that day. Even Meisner commented on how pretty she was. The typical fetching Southeastern University co-ed was a lovely pharmacist's daughter with a hard little body, dairy-made complexion, and the soul of a robber baron. Cassidy had no idea what made Andrea so different, but he could sense that she had somehow survived 20 years as an attractive female in the Republic without having had her mind reamed out by Mama, the Junior League, or Helen Gurley Brown. Several days later on the 3-mile warm-up, they saw her again. "Try to smooth it out a little," Cassidy suggested as they passed. He demonstrated with an exaggerated version of the classical running stride, a stride that he did not use himself when the chips were down. She looked up, her damp forehead wrinkled with concentration, and stared at Cassidy as if he were some aquatic parasite that had attached itself to her ankle while she was wading in the creek. Cassidy nearly swooned. "You're crazy," Meisner told him. "She appreciated the advice," Cassidy decided. "She thinks you're crazy, too. How do you figure? What would you do if some guy out of the blue just up and starts critiquing your stride? Challenge him to a race. If his T-shirt said Pittsburgh Holy Rollers and he started prancing around like this, you'd think he was crazy, too. And you'd be right." "Mize, the girl was clearly grateful. She appreciated the advice," Cassidy repeated, troubled. "The girl," Meisner was annoyed, "has a gimpy leg. I saw it yesterday when she was stretching up at the track. She probably not only didn't appreciate the advice, she probably thinks you're an asshole." "Oh." But giving up quickly was not in Quentin Cassidy's nature. A week later, he saw her at the Gay 90s, a rather unfortunately named and remarkably heterosexual tavern. Her blonde hair was down, but there was no mistaking her. Her white cotton blouse made her thin arms look very tanned, and for some reason the sight of her made his heart hurt. He waited around until her two girlfriends got up to play foosball, then made his slew-footed entrance. She saw him coming. "Well, well, the coach," she said. It was only faintly sarcastic. She even smiled a little, he thought. "Ah, yes, well, I..." He spilled a trickle of beer as he started to make some expansive gesture. Idiotically, he began licking foam off his wrist. "Don't do that," she said. "Right. Look, I'm sorry if I..." "That's all right. I was a little annoyed, but then I figured you might have taken a class or something, and maybe even knew what you were talking about." "Not really," he said happily, sliding into the booth across from her. "But I know a bunch of guys who are really good." "Are you on the track team or something?" "Yes, indeed," he said, feeling slightly loony watching her green flame eyes in the pale tavern light. "Oh, my. What event do you do?" "Decathlon," he said. "Really?" she asked. "How far do you throw it?" They drifted, dappled by the hard cypress shadows out into the burning September sun. They drifted in one of those pleasant, cool eddies life sometimes affords the young in fall or spring. They drifted, quite unaware of the not-so-far-off rattle of bones. "I didn't ask to go see the movie," she said. "I thought the book was sophomoric, Baroque and sophomoric. The movie was your idea." "It was my fault. But your friends were just asking. My friends think love story is the finest literature to come down the pike since The Prophet. You should have eased up on them. Someday they will be producing babies and not causing anyone any trouble at all." "All I meant was that such cornpone has a way of co-opting real life. I mean, it's fun to talk snazzy and run around and play in the snow with your girl, for Christ's sakes, but I don't know if I'll ever be able to throw a dog a frisbee without thinking I should be in slow motion or something." "Tear ducts raped. I resent having my tear ducts raped, I believe is what you said." "Aw." "And we're following up with something about teensy-weensy sexual members of dope-crazed screenwriters or something." "Well, Mary Ellen Connesty was close to having a stroke. She's a harmless girl, Quentin. You're going to have to break in a little slower with some people." He looked over and gave her what he thought of as his pixie grin. "Don't give me that pixie grin crap," she told him. They drifted. Cassidy was plopped without grace in his inner tube, his white bottom now thoroughly chilled by the icy waters of the Itchituckney River. Andrea somehow accomplished a similar position without the same loss of dignity. On her, it looked sultry. When she leaned back to take the sun, he looked carefully at the two brown legs draped over the edge of her tube, but could hardly detect the difference between them that would forever put a little catch in her walk. Of course there would be something like that. He lacked interest in the perfect item. Quentin Cassidy, unmoved by kittens, sonnets, and sunsets, was nonetheless given to tragic flaws. In order to arrange this day of perfect drifting, an entirely traditional local pastime, he and Meisner, now floating up ahead with his date, had arisen at 7:30 and run 17 miles. It was the only way they could spend their day in the sweet haze of Boone's Farm apple wine and still appease the great white calendar god, whose slighted or empty squares would surely turn up someday to torment the guilt-ridden runner. They went through such contortions occasionally to prove to themselves that their lives didn't have to be so abnormal, but the process usually just ended up accentuating the fact. There were several ways it could be done. If they were going to the beach, they might put it off and run when they got there. But, contrary to popular opinion, beach running is only jolly fun for the first 5 miles or so. After that, the cute little waves become redundant. The sand reflects the sun up into the eyes blindingly. Grains of sand slip annoyingly into the heel of the shoe or flip up on the back of the leg. 15 hot miles on a long, flat beach sounds like good sport only to those who haven't actually done it. Also, the ocean is too infinite. The run seems as if it will never end. They could always put training off until they got back in the evening, but that just made things worse. No beer! None of the sticky wine! Their friends would slyly try to tempt them, see if they really took all that training stuff seriously. It was too much to ask. Better to get it all over with and then be able to enjoy the day like any other citizen. Though he hated running long in the morning more than anything he could think of, Cassidy was ecstatic to have his whole day's training behind him. The oversized tubes floated along on the gin-clear river, meandering slowly under the spooky cypress stands and pleasantly out into splotches of sun. Even though it was Florida, it was North Florida, and as winter approached, tubing would be forgotten until spring. Cassidy paddled over awkwardly to Andrea's tube and invited her to double up. Flirting with disaster for several seconds, she finally accomplished the maneuver. "Next time you do the transfer at sea, please," she said. Her warmth beside him was searing. She smelled of summer, youth, sea and ski, and moist, slightly sweet sex. Clearly edible. His head spun from the wine and the sun. Muscles along the top of his thighs trembled from his morning exertion. In a month or so, he knew they would carry him screaming around the track. He had the power. "Ouch," she said. "What's that all about?" 8. Dick Doobie. The head football coach pushed the sweaty baseball cap back on his bristly crew-cut head, leaned way back in his $1,495 execucliner, plopped his ripple-soled coaching shoes up on his gigantic gleaming desk, and wondered what in the world was becoming of him. With mournful pride, he surveyed the wide expanse of lush maroon and silver carpeting that displayed in the very center a custom-woven and very savage-looking Daryl the Swamp Dog. The office was so large as to invite speculation as to which indoor sports might be accommodated. The Rotarians had been most unkind. Whereas several years ago he would have been treated with the unbridled respect and admiration due a United States senator or even a big-money media evangelist, This day's luncheon had been laced with a certain ill-concealed nastiness that now knitted Dick Doobie's brow like a $10 potholder. L.T. Doches, owner of the Fat Boys Pit Barbecue off Interstate 75, had posed the question. Since Doobie's first 3 years had allegedly been rebuilding years for the old swamp dogs, and keeping in mind certain early and somewhat rash predictions, in retrospect, how did the coach view this past season's 4-6 record? As LT put it, "I mean, are we going to start rebuilding again without seeing what it was we got ourselves built the last time?" It was a mouthful of a question, LT having obviously practiced it some, but he delivered it without a flaw and, to the affirmative grumbles and guffaws of the group, replaced his pear-shaped bottom on the Holiday Inn folding chair, Dick Doobie, meanwhile, discerning all he wanted to know about the general Rotarian mood. A little surprised by the brewing hostility, he babbled something about real fine junior college transfers, some red shirts who would be a real great help to us out there next year, and a few other favorite mouth-worn Doobie maxims. Kernsville cynics suspected that the NCAA held yearly seminars for the purpose of allowing football coaches to swap these fluffs of wisdom back and forth. Doobie's favorite was, "In order to win, you got to avoid losing first." Things like that. The same material that at one time would have at least won nodding approval now netted him a few muffled coughs. He was dying up there with a live mic and a glass of watery iced tea. He tried to tell some funny anecdotes, generally racially tinged, mangled one-liners uttered by some player or another, the punchline of which inevitably began, "Well, gosh, coach." As a last resort, he told some of his "my daddy used to say" chestnuts that always won chuckles of nostalgia for the old man, if not appreciation for his fumbling offspring. Nothing worked. Finally, one sports writer, a short Jewish fella Doobie disliked intensely, asked Doobie's opinion of the "Dump Dick Doobie" bumper stickers that were showing up on cars in and around Kernsville. Doobie cleared his throat. "Well, now, there has always been dissident elements, you see, in our American system, and while these people may think they are doing the right thing, and while they are certainly entitled to their opinion, you see, such disloyalty to the program can only..." This tack also netted him little in the way of positive Rotarian feedback. It was becoming painfully obvious to him that many of these very Rotarians were either among the dissident elements or were sympathetic to them. Dick Doobie was discovering that a football coach in a small southern town walks upon water only if he is either rebuilding or else wailing the tar out of Ole Miss. There is no middle ground called holding your own. And you can sell the rebuilding excuse only so long before you find your career folding up like a 10-year-old roadmap. Uprisings are fomented, Rotarians go on cautious rampages, and, oh, the infamy, the very bumpers of automobiles call for your destruction. Dick Doobie took his feet off the desk and pressed the intercom. "Mary Lou, come on in here a minute, will you, hon?" His mind reeled with daring, if half-baked, stratagems. Mary Lou, hoping for hanky-panky, bounced in, miniskirted and primed for action. She sported an alarming beehive hairdo.
"Shall I get the key to the whirlpool?" she asked coyly.
Not now, hon. I need you to take something down for me."
Frowning slightly, she left to get her steno pad.
"This will be a memo to all coaches from Dick Doobie as athletic director, not head football coach. You, don't need to write all that down, hon. I mean, word for word and all. Like, when I said, not head football coach, you didn't need to write, not head, well, you know what to put."
Her shoulders sagged impatiently.
"What an incredible mind," she thought.
They went through something like this nearly every time. Doobie waited self-consciously for a moment, as if to allow his words to fall from the air so he could start fresh.
Ahem. New rules on hair grooming and dress, procedures for Southeastern University athletes.
9. An afternoon. The runners circled the big grass field in a slow, prancing jog, their shirtless bodies gleaming with sweat. As they trotted by Ben Cornwall, they all looked up at him almost simultaneously. Their rasping and coughing grew louder as they approached.
138. Two to go, guys, the coach told them.
They immediately lowered their heads and continued jogging. They were on their rest interval, respite in the acid storm. Cornwall walked back across the field to catch the next 660 on his split timer. A 3:30 jog wasn't much recovery time, and he could tell by the strain on their faces that they were working hard. The last two would be quicker, perhaps, but Cassidy and Meisner had made sure the first six were evenly paced and fast. Cornwall studied his two star runners as he crossed the field to the opposite post. They looked less distraught than the rest, but not by much. Cassidy was saying something to Meisner, who replied with a thin smile. Cornwall couldn't hear it, of course, and wouldn't have understood if he had. The conversation, between gasps, went like this.
"There must be some mistake," Cassidy said. "I have not yet attained that sense of euphoria commonly reported by runners."
"You are speaking, no doubt, of the fabled third wind."
"I'm not sure. I haven't read Runner's World lately, so I don't know what they are calling it this month."
When they reached the post, Cornwall clicked the expensive timer and studied with admiration the easy power of the runners flowing into their long strides. The head track coach, oddly enough, didn't know a great deal about distance running. Cassidy and Meisner were constantly, though very unobtrusively, amending his workouts, having been a javelin man in college. But Cornwall understood that the half-milers, milers, and true distance men were the heart of a track team. They could run everything from the mile relay on up. It was imperative that he pay attention to their training. He had learned very early, though, that the milers and distance men were like seeds. The good ones, given minimum care, just grew on their own. He had only a casual jogger's appreciation for their training. He knew from his own days of conditioning that what they were doing before his eyes was far beyond his ken, and he knew the daily grind took its toll. The attrition rate was startling. Even the most promising runners, disheartened by injuries or poor performances, would sometimes leave their scholarships on his desk. He never tried to talk them out of it. He knew that once they lost it, it was gone for good. Now, as he watched across the big field, the runners entered the far turn with Cassidy and Meisner still leading. Up close, their breathing would make a considerable racket, but from here they appeared to be gliding along without effort. From the middle of the pack, a shorter runner moved up to their shoulders. Without even having to squint, Cornwall knew it would be Nubbins. If they didn't break him, Cornwall thought, that Nubbins might turn out to be something after all. Entering the far straight, Cassidy and Meisner picked up the pace slightly, and only Nubbins hung on with them. They seemed to sense his presence, but showed no outward sign of it. In an interval workout, there was no objection to a hard finish, so long as the early running had been even and taxing. Dogging in the early stages in order to shine later on was considered antisocial behavior. Cassidy saved his fiercest workout kick for such occasions. But Nubbins had been conscientious and was now making a bid for status. He knew very well Cornwall was watching closely. Cassidy slackened somewhat, and Nubbins went by, pulling up to Meisner as they came out of the turn. But when the freshman bore down in the last straight and tried to pull away, Meisner matched him stride for stride. Cornwall smiled as he clicked the split timer for them. He looked down at the watch and thought, Jesus, they had run 1:28. Nubbins looked entirely washed out, a face without hope or humor, but he kept on jogging. Cassidy caught up to Meisner, and they trotted along without speaking. Cornwall still did not understand that pairing. They were so different. Cassidy was breezy, almost light-hearted for a runner.
Meisner was studious and serene. But they were identical in one respect. The haunted cast of their eyes as they entered a gun lap was exactly the same. The coach walked back across the field, still studying Cassidy and Meisner jogging through their rest interval. "Those two," he thought. "I'll never get another pair like them. Just read the watch for them, see they get fed, get them their plane tickets, and keep them in shoes. No small expense. And they'll go out and win everything in sight." They were chugging up to him now, looking up from their despondent jog with the same expectant expression. It always amused him how interested they were in the numbers, no matter how exhausted. It was the first thing they wanted to know after a race, even from the depths of their distress. "Leaders 128, Cass 129.5. Everyone else hit at about 133. Last one, fellas." The runners were jogging especially slowly now. This was the way they always did it. Everyone would want to be as fresh as possible for the last one in order to end on an upbeat. Actually, they would still be out of breath when they started the last one, and Cornwall thought again how surprising it was that after the first several intervals they looked as bad as they would get. The rest seemed to take no more out of them, though he knew each one had to be more difficult than the one before. But then they blew into the last one like they couldn't think of a better way to end the day. They were a strange crowd, runners, Cornwall thought. They were strange back in his track days, and they were still strange. They finally arrived at the starting post with their mincing little steps, and with a deep gasp leaned into the last one as Cornwall clicked the watch. They flew into the first turn, and Cornwall smiled again. Cassidy was already 10 yards in front. By the time they were out of the turn and into the far straight, he was 25 yards ahead and still telescoping away. Meisner smoothly led the rest of the pack. Around the final turn and into the straightaway, Cassidy powered on with crisp, business-like strides. There was a lift in his stride, and from his expression, Cornwall could tell he was serious. 40 yards in front, Cassidy flashed by the post, and Cornwall flicked the watch at him in that strange little gotcha affectation of earnest timers everywhere. The coach let out a little grunt as he glanced briefly at the watch before catching the others on the second sweeping hand. Cassidy did not keep jogging as before, but curved back in a parabola of expectation.
"Why didn't you get your ass in gear, Cassidy?" the coach asked.
Cassidy was still gasping and unamused.
"Come on, coach. What was it?"
"You think I don't know when you guys are loafing?"
Cassidy rolled his eyes at that, but stood panting, hands on hips. Let him have his fun.
"You had 124.6, the coach smiled. "Everyone else was right about 129.
Cassidy nodded, satisfied, and started to jog off toward Bruce Denton, who stood wringing wet, watching from the side of the field.
"That's about right," Cassidy called back. "Last year would have been 126-something about this time."
Cornwall knew how accurate his training records were, and that Cassidy wasn't guessing.
"You might even do some good in cross-country pretty soon you keep this up," the coach called out to him. He knew it was a sore point.
Meisner had caught up to the other pair as they headed off for the one-mile warm-down course.
"Right," Cassidy called back, "and I might run the 109 flat and play wide receiver for the Dolphins."
Cassidy slumped on the bench, draped immodestly with a towel, more or less savoring the deep, itchy ache of the last 660, and apparently studying his toes with great interest. He would be losing another nail soon. Ugliest feet in the world, he thought, next to Denton's. He ran his hand up and down his left Achilles tendon. Very tender. Better pay attention to it and back off if it gets any worse. Maybe ice it. The old injury evasion fandango. Did it ever end? The afternoon workout had cost him 7 pounds. He longed for cooler weather. In the shower, Denton laughed.
"It's the lean wolf that leads the pack."
"If I am captured in Indochina," Cassidy told him, "I will not last out the night in a bamboo cage."
Just walk out between the bars, Denton had suggested.
The older runner had been impressed with the 660 workout, but mildly disapproved of doing hard intervals so early in the year. He had settled for a 12-mile run himself.
It's easy for you to criticize, Cassidy said, still slumping on the bench while Denton dressed quickly. You won't be doing the old 1-mile run on some little 11-lap roller derby track in a few weeks. I need me some get-down speed out there.
When did you turn into a black sprinter? Meisner asked. What's this get-down stuff?
He's a miler person, you see, Denton said, and he's explaining about how it's dog-eat-dog out there. Right, sport?
Into the steamy and subdued post-workout atmosphere charged Daniel Hayes Ingram, a student trainer whose round face was a sad pink-and-white topographical map of adolescence. In high school, Ingram had secured a place on the track team and set about accomplishing his lifelong goal, a 5-minute mile. Having failed by 3.4 seconds, he learned how to tape ankles and apply ice packs and was thus spared eternal exile from that intimate neutral world where the sounds were of rushing water, rough laughter, and the click-clack of brittle spikes on tiled floors. Substitute gratification does not vent completely the deeper yearnings, however, and Danny Ingram was known as a highly excitable person. He now clucked and sputtered with such energy as to gather a small crowd. If the news was not of interest, they would at least get to watch a trainer go mad.
They got Walton! Ingram gasped for the third time.
The track men looked at one another.
John Walton, you idiots! They got John Walton!
Ingram was exasperated by their blank stares. They knew who he was talking about, but could not get the context. They calmed him with abuse and made him begin slowly. He had their interest now, and they were going to get to the bottom of this.
I was just in Cornwall's office.
He took a deep breath.
And the telegram just came in from the New Zealand Travel Committee. Walton has agreed to run in the Southeastern University relays this spring. He's on tour then and had the weekend open. Holy Jesus Christ, John Walton running here! Won't that just be something else now? Can you imagine what he'll do to all these yokels around here when he...
It was a particularly awkward thing to say, for as the import of the news had finally come across, the others had turned almost as a man to see what kind of reaction would issue from the distance runner's corner, where Cassidy and Denton sat watching them with great interest.
Well, I didn't mean you, of course, Cass.
But the trainer was clearly into his own pit, and his clambering around only brought more debris down upon himself. It was very quiet. Big fans in the roof beat at the hot air.
"Who did you say was coming to the relays, Danny?"
Cassidy asked.
Walton. John Walton. The miler from New...
John Walton? Is he supposed to be pretty good? Cassidy maintained a countenance of innocent curiosity. Denton turned slightly and coughed.
"Yeah, well, he's only run 3:49 and all."
Some of the others were snickering, but Danny had a very high embarrassment threshold.
"Say, Cass,"
he was all curiosity now,
"how do you think you'll handle, you know, the situation?"
Cassidy pondered. He looked at the ceiling and sphincterized his lips. Then his face lit up. Inspiration.
"I think what I would do would be to hang right with him, see? Yeah, well, check him out real close, like for a couple of laps. Make him take the initiative, see? Make him run my race, see?"
Denton was leaning against his locker, biting on a towel.
"But John Walton, I mean when he..."
"Then, going into the last lap, I'll be right on his tail, see? All the way into the last turn."
"But they say his kick..."
"Then I'll take a shortcut across the infield, sprint down the pole vault runway, and lean at the tape. Works every time." The assemblage dispersed in what might be called a good mood, but there was an eeriness in the air. Some names were uttered with reverence in that tiled sanctum, and John Walton's was one of them.
Surely Bruce Denton's name was accorded similar respect in other locker rooms around the world, but there was always something even more mysterious and exotic about those far-off heroes, rarely seen in person, whose feats were frozen for all time in irrefutable black-and-white numerals. Walton's aura, as the first human being to run the mile under 350, was that of almost total invincibility. To the public, he may have been just one more in a long line of champions, but to those whose own numerals gave credentials of insight, Walton's name brought with it an unpleasant chill. A 355-miler would understand it better than a 405-miler. Walton was the best there was, but he was only an image to most of them. And now that he was to be viewed in person, take the form of flesh and blood, no one knew quite what to think. Bruce Denton was an Olympian. He was accustomed to unstable atmospheres where heady names such as Walton's were bandied about like so many harmless acquaintances. But these undergraduates clearly were not, despite their best efforts to act nonchalant.
"Ah, he pulls on his shorts the same way we do," said one of the freshmen, but it didn't dispel Walton's ghost in the least.
"That's right," Denton chuckled. "Except he pulls his shorts up over legs that can run a mile in 3 minutes and 49 seconds.
Some of them laughed as they finished dressing, but there was no further discussion. Cassidy still sat on the bench, towel draped across his middle, too weary even to clothe himself. He looked up at Denton and smiled. His 660 workout didn't seem like such hot stuff anymore. An awesome creature, up until recently more myth than mortal, was to assume human form and cross oceans to perform his magic rite on the same track that held their sweat. In doing so, he would necessarily devastate those who sought to test his power. That this force would be inexorably brought to bear upon one they all knew, one they had come to respect for his own prowess, made everyone at the same time uneasy and strangely elated. They had rarely seen Quentin Cassidy lose a mile race, did not want to see him lose, yet the inevitability of the prospect was somehow exciting in the manner of an execution. Their lion was to be devoured by a greater lion.
10. Demons. "It's demons, you see," Cassidy said seriously. He was on the floor doing his stretching. Andrea was propped on one elbow on his bed, looking up from her organic chemistry book, suppressing amusement, something she often seemed to do. She pushed a wisp of hair back from her glasses and looked entirely scholarly.
"Do they whisper moral imperatives in your ear?"
"Lovely. I try to explain the dark forces at work within me, and you amuse yourself."
"Oh, I'm sorry. Please do go on." "And on. And on."
He caught her by an ankle, the good one, and flipped her neatly onto the floor beside him. The back of her neck smelled like a parakeet's tummy, sweet hay and fluff.
He said, lost in the pale corn silk of her hair.
She muddled his thought processes, such as they were. He had difficulty studying when she was about. Colors muted, and he reached for her without guile or guilt. He adored her and told her so. She, on the other hand, had no handle on Quentin Cassidy. He said things occasionally that brought her up short. She would shake her head and say, "Queer duck." He acted not at all like the many boys who had sought her attentions. This one wore a great weariness about the eyes, yet ironically with an incredible well of silly energy bubbling just beneath the surface. He rambled at times, talking in streaks of lucid prose, then lapsed into deep silences from which he could not be retrieved without great effort. He cavorted. He played with her mind. She had watched him race 4 times now. He had tried to pass off these competitions as inconsequential, but during those times especially, he was lost to her. She wondered where he went, leaving her excluded, lonely, and, could she admit this, jealous. She wondered what interior provinces she was not privy to, and repeatedly asked him to explain what he was talking about. This she knew. There were times when she drew only polite responses. She could have been for all the world a distant cousin come to visit.
"What do your demons make you do?" she said softly, holding his head and making curls absently with his ragged blonde hair. He sighed. "About 16-18 miles a day."
"Hmm." She started to push him away, perturbed at not being taken seriously.
"But sometimes, when it is all going good, I mean, when it's early May warm and there's cut grass in the air and you've made it through winter okay, not bad sick or anything, then sometimes you can take a deep breath and feel your own heart jumping." "That's right, don't look at me like that. You can feel your own heart in there jumping around like a goddamn bobcat or something. That's when you've just got to get yourself out somewhere and let them loose."
Her head cocked at this. She watched him closely.
"Don't try to make me feel funny about this," he said. "You were the one who wanted to know. Besides, you've never been in 4-minute shape. Not that many people have. So if you think this is all just a crock..."
"No," she said quickly. "Go on, I want to hear it."
"They make you want to run through the jungle, baby," he said happily. "Cover countryside at a clip. Slide by in the night like a scuttling cloud."
His eyes had the faraway cast, but his voice quavered in mock solemnity like a southern tent evangelist. Sensing genuine interest, he picked up the tempo.
"They make you bolt awake in the middle of the night with an involuntary shot of your own true adrenaline, ready to run 100 miles. We're talking when you're there now, really there, 4-minute shape or better. They make you jittery with the smell of the forest, ready to hurdle fallen trees, run down game, leave gore in the bushes." Her eyes widened. "And then when you get them all reined in..." He looked at her fiercely. "They make you lay back in the pack, coasting 3 laps on an old melody, and then they make you wail out of the final turn and blow down the last goddamn straightaway like the midnight train to hell."
Although he said it humorously in his mock religious voice, in his eyes she could see, but not quite penetrate, limpid ethers of a faraway Elysium, where the otherworldly citizens were without exception vessels of nearly pure spirit, heavyweight prize fighters, rare air mountain climbers, soon to be martyred saints, and other quiet, sadly ironic purveyors of the difficult task.
"You are, of course, quite mad," she said softly. "Come," he said, breaking the spell. "We have to meet Mize at the 90s.
"We are speaking of human endeavor and delusional systems," Cassidy said, punctuating with a steady cracking of pistachio nuts. Their second pitcher was almost gone. Thursday night foosball and pinball background noise nearly precluded conversation altogether. "Everyone likes to think they have their own little corner. It can be anything. Needlepoint, lawn bowling, whatever. Some guy may gratify himself by thinking he's the best goddamn fruit and vegetable manager the A&P ever had. Which is fine. It gives people a sense of worth in a crowded world where everyone feels like part of the scenery. But then mostly they are spared any harrowing glimpses into their own mediocrity. Pillsbury Bake Off notwithstanding, we'll never really know who makes the best artichoke souffle in the world, will we?"
"Gotcha. Don't filibuster, tell me demons," she said.
"Right. The thing is that in track, we are painfully and constantly aware of how we stack up. Not just with our contemporaries, but with our historical counterparts as well. In that regard, it's different even from other sports. A basketball player can go out and have a great day and tell himself he's the greatest rebounding forward to ever hit the hardwood. But he'll never really be troubled by the actual truth, will he? Maybe he's just in a weak league. Maybe Jumping Joe Falks would have eaten him alive 30 years ago, but he'll never know. He'll just have to leave such judgments in the sorry hands of the sports writers, many of whom, it has been pointed out, can be bought with a stake."
Meisner nodded vigorously from behind a pile of popcorn. In track, it's all there in black and white. Lots of people can't take that kind of pressure. The ego withers in the face of the evidence. We all carry our little credentials around with us. That's why the numbers are so important to us, why we're always talking about them. I am, for instance, 4.3. The numerals might as well be etched on my forehead. This gentleman here, perhaps you'd like to meet him, is 2742, also known as 1321, I believe. Meisner bowed graciously, half rising. He seemed to be enjoying this immensely. A knowledgeable observer might ask yards or meters, and it is most assuredly yards, Meisner said. I'll not puff.
What?
Never mind, Cassidy interrupted. The point is that we know not only whether we are good, bad, or mediocre, but whether we're first, third, or 197th at any given point. Track and field news tells us whether we want to know or not. Assuming we make the lists, Meisner put in. That's right. Sometimes it is possible, despite your best efforts and 100 goddamn miles a week, not to even exist.
That bothers you, doesn't it?
That, my dear, breaks my heart.
But you can beat almost everyone. We know that, right? Isn't that good? Isn't that what you want?
Well, sure. But in my own mind, I know that I'm what a sports writer would call a steady performer. And it really doesn't matter a whit how many races I win. I haven't even broken 4 minutes yet. Roger Bannister did that back in 1954. I've spent 7 years of my life working hard at this thing, and so far I'm average. It happens to others, concert pianists maybe, actors and the like, but they aren't subject to the cold, cruel numbers like we are. Let's put it this way, he continued. There is a fellow right now in New Haven, one in Kansas, one in Boston, one somewhere in Minnesota, of all places, and two, Mize is now indicating three, in Oregon, who might very reasonably